Okay, ladies and gentlemen, for some of us at least, this is sort of the final lap of this marathon, or at least 800 meter marathon. Was long, was that long, it was only 2 days, I mean, an English mile maybe, of this conference, and we have the opportunity to sort of bring up some of the questions that we've been dealing with the last couple of days again. But before we move on, I'd like to thank Sheila again for a wonderful talk and for taking the task that she was given so seriously. I mean, not all keynotes do that, you know. There are keynotes that will do quite differently, but you took it very seriously and illustrating the fact that STS is at this conference as, in general, a case of... question of disciplines and disciplinarity, but also a tool for analyzing it. And for, I'd also like to thank you for daring to be yourself the case and not just the analytic looking at STS from outside, which is quite an amazing thing, I think. So it's a great place to start this discussion. I just remind you that we'll start discussion here in the panel, and then we'll, with the case of STS, then we'll expand both thematically and, let's say, what the participants are concerned. So I hope to end up sort of in a cacophonic thing where we discuss all the questions that we've been discussing the 3 last days. So we'll see how that works. But anyway, so I just introduced you to the panel. Sheila, you've just heard. Adolf van der Schlaffen from Ghent, professor of sociology. Then a new face to the conference, or not to the conference, but to the, I mean, up here, is this Jane Summergen, who is the director of Center for Technology, Innovation and Culture at the Faculty of Social Sciences in Oslo. And then Olof Stichwes, professor of sociology at Bonn, who was also a keynote. So there you are. And then since Jane is sort of the new face in the crowd, we've asked her to sort of kick this off with some comments on in regard to Sheila's talk. So, Jane,
thank you.
Take it away.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. It's been very nice to be here. Those of us who have been at the conference all the time will not agree that I'm the new face, because I've been sitting in the back the
True.
Whole time.
True, not.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed Sheila's talk. Yeah, I think she saw me smiling in recognition there in the back. And... actually, the question that I was wanting to bring up in this panel discussion, and also get perspectives from Ralph and Rudolf and all of you here, really relates to what Sheila brought up, which is, you know, in this rhetoric of interdisciplinarity and transdisciplinarity, cross, you know, there's all this rhetoric and there's this enthusiasm and there have been gains made. But, you know, basically, you know, interdisciplinarity is about intellectual and institutional space. Or rather, spaces for asking new questions, bringing up issues that might not have been raised, formulating problems, that type of thing. And as such, if we ask the question, I was making some notes here, it's about like creating the material resources and the material conditions for having this type of space. Sheila was talking about the room of your own. I mean, an STS perspective, you have to have money, you have to have office spaces, you have to have long-term material commitments and institutional support. We have to also nurture these spaces as creative places for people to be, and that's the, you know, epistemological challenge there. We have to sustain these spaces, and we were talking, a few of us, that this is not particular to interdisciplinarity. We all, in our disciplines, also have to fight to sustain the intellectual and institutional spaces we have. So if we have that as a background, I'd like to ask these questions. Lars Quartrup asked the other day, what is actually happening? So in relation to the rhetoric, I would like to ask, you know, what is happening in our various places on the globe? Are our intellectual and institutional spaces increasing, decreasing? You know, or is our space in the archipelago secure? Is it, maybe it shouldn't really be secure in one sense. But how is, what is looking? Where are we seeing successes in institutionalizing? Why are we seeing these? For whom? And that type of thing. And then we have the idea of those of us who are lucky enough to be in places, spaces, that seem nurturing and seem secure, but also under tension to continually develop and defend yourself, which I think is teak, which is a very positive way, I think. What can we share with others about some of the things that have been important for us? And there are no general answers to this, because one of, I think, lessons also from Sheila's very nice talk was this local situatedness of the different contingencies and preconditions. Harvard was different from Cornell, and it's different from Oslo, and it's different from Sweden. So I think instead of talking about the boundary work, which we often do, we can also talk about our disciplines as boundary objects and having to interact with others. And I think it would be interesting to talk about what are the implications for what is happening now, to Lewis Law's statement, for, you know, new people coming into the field, people who would like to have a space here institutionally. That's just what I want to bring up.
Great. Wonderful. Sheila, would you like to sort of pick that up? Since you were the one who introduced the idea of kinds of spaces, architectural spaces, and other spaces.
Thanks. And Jane, thank you for that nice summation and the framing of the question. There actually is a lot of newness being created, and from where I sit in the States and look around, there's a distinct difference between what's going on the natural sciences and engineering side of the world and the rest of the Wissenschaften. So the natural sciences seem to have relatively a much lower threshold to create new things. So just in the time that I've been at Harvard, I know of a couple of major new departments, that is undergraduate degree granting, graduate degree granting. One of them is on stem cell biology. And, of course, one can see very clearly why that was created. And my scientist friends are actually a little bit aghast, because they don't think stem cell biology is such a foundational topic that it should actually be consuming university resources of the sort that are required. But nevertheless, you know, it came into being with very little conflict and so on. A more sort of problematic thing that's happening is that around major American research universities, environment is becoming imperceptibly less interesting as a coalescence point for people, and people are gravitating away to more utilitarian formulations like energy. So at Harvard, we've got a new energy consortium, and it's offering some educational opportunities and so on and so forth. But you know, you see in all of these examples a sort of response to things driven by a set of popular demands. I mean, so very much mode two type considerations, kind of divorced from any reflection, any meta consideration of what's needed. So I see, you know, that interdisciplinarity rhetoric as actually being quite powerful and catching on to different degrees in different places, but not doing it in a particularly, not doing it in at all a reflective way, very much reflecting or following the realities of present-day political economy. And, you know, I don't know how that corresponds to things going on the European side, but perhaps our colleagues will speak a little bit to that.
Good. Yeah, I think, Ralph, I mean, your point had all to do with space also, but more geographical space, the difference between... Ralph gave a talk on the establishment of the history of sciences as a discipline with the case of the journal ISIS, and it was a lot about geography, in a sense, or geographical spaces, and how disciplines can move between continents and what happens to them. And that would relate to this as well, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm.
Maybe make a bit of a more general remark. If you look at the kind of disciplines which have developed in the, let's say, in the post-World War period, so after the Second World War, one can say in a more general sense, there was an enormous boost, growth of the university system in terms of numbers, especially at the American continent, later also in Europe. And this is a kind of expansion which took place, let's say, from the 1950s to towards the middle of the 1970s. And simply the demography change that created the possibility for a large number of new disciplines or sub-disciplines to emerge. Mm-hmm. And you have a number of them which emerged in the 1950s and 60s. And from that point of view, we can say that STS is relatively late. It is, mm-hmm. one can say, if you look at, for example, the moment that the 3S is, or 4S is found, it's 1975. That is at the moment when you have the energy crisis and so on, in which the expansion is already slowing down. Mm-hmm. And that means that you have a relatively young generation who is there, but who stays their entire career over there. And many of them will have to leave the academia. They cannot continue their career. And I think that is something which has, in a way, had a negative effect upon STS. If it would have been created, let's say, a decade before, there would have been more people who would have been able to find places at the university, but it's kind of serendipity or a kind of path dependency, in the sense that it came relatively late, and I think that had an effect on the way that it could position itself. Others were there and, in a way, occupied territory which was there. And especially, I think, for the US, that was, well, history of science was already there, and then that not just they took not just the buildings, but they occupied part of this space. Mm. And I think that is a kind of, let's say, an infrastructure or a kind of demographic argument which I think still defines until today what the kind of possibilities are for STS.
Yeah. You want
to? Yeah, I want to add one point. I think in one respect, what we discuss here is a question which always arises in science. Who is there a privileged observer who is privileged to observe some reality? For example, theology may be the privileged observer of God, or economics, privileged observer of economic behavior. And if we look to science, is there a privileged observer of science in contemporary society? And in some respects, that's the question. And I think we have an interesting development. We had such a privileged observer. As I understand it, that was philosophy of science. But we have a very, very remarkable, very fast decline of philosophy of science since the 60s. It understood itself as a kind of normative science of how to do science. And as such a normative enterprise, it was completely unsuccessful. Scientists liked to read Popper on the height of his fame, but he had no influence on their practices. And it's a long story, but philosophy of science, I say in a strong mode, is dead in many respects. There was a very small undertaking. And then came, and that was a story Raf told, then came a new candidate, history of science. But as I'm not sure if you listen to read your story in the same way, but I take your story as a kind of proof that history of science is a very limited undertaking. It's only connected with itself. That's something what your data really demonstrated. It doesn't connect with STS. It doesn't really connect with history, and that's dramatic. Historians of science do not really belong to the profession of history. And that means all the currents of thought, which are very interesting, which happen to arise and to disappear in the profession and discipline of history, have no real influence. It's a very, in many respects, it's a discipline, a small discipline, but it's a little bit sterile. One has to say it. And that means, and that's the last point I want to make, the position of the privileged observer of science in the system of science is vacant. There is a vacancy. And we have. I see two options. The one is the option Sheila presented. STS as a rising discipline which fills this vacancy in the system of science. But there may arise some doubts. What is the problem constellation? What is the conceptual apparatus? What, and so on. I don't know the answer, and I see one alternative, at least one, probably there are more alternatives, but one alternative I see, of course, it might be, and that's, I can look at myself as a case study. I do research on science for 30 years at least, but I always understood myself in a very strict sense as a general sociologist who has a strong comparative interest, and among these comparative interests belongs comparing science with other knowledge systems in the social world. And that could be the alternatives. We have economists of science, psychologists of science, sociologists of science, and they do some interdisciplinary work, but they exhaust the conceptual possibilities inherent in their disciplines to apply them on the study of science. That are the two alternatives. Probably there are more. For example, and that was something which somehow appeared in Sheila's talk, for example, Foucault. That was only one person, influential, but only one person. His chair was History of Thought Systems. Has not been taken by somebody else in this way, but that's an option. Or descriptive epistemology of cognitive social systems, Donald Campbell, whom I find more interesting than Foucault. But again, only one person, influential, but no institution builder. That, there may be other alternatives, but my main point is I see this vacancy, and that's what we discuss, speak about.
Well, so, Rudolf, thank you for putting it so clearly. It is exactly those positions that I was profoundly disagreeing with. Mm-hmm. I think that for STS strategically to claim a privileged position with regard to science is going to be a non-starter, for a reason that you didn't explicitly mention, which is that the people who claim to have the privileged position to talk about science are the scientists themselves. And this manifests itself in a whole lot of different institutional ramifications, like the claim, how can you be an STS scholar without having a PhD in the sciences and without having a scientific training? So, you can go on and on from there. The science wars were in part exactly a fight about this privileged position to speak about the sciences. And, I'm sure you're well aware that it was spearheaded by people from physics and collaborating with some people. The Higher Superstition book was actually co-authored by a mathematician and a biologist, but the people who really sort of successfully waged that battle were physicists who were suffering from particular drawbacks of their own at that time. So I think that the privileged position of STS should not be defined as speaking about science. I mean, I just do not think that that definition is going to work out. I think that the privileged position for STS has more to do with saying there are distinct realms of creative human activity that actually have a bearing on how we organize ourselves, our conceptual universes, how we relate to one another, profoundly shape the condition of humanity. And when there are activities that so profoundly shape the human condition, there should be a para, meta, whatever it is, critical activity going on at the same time. So, we make movies and we have film studies and film critics and blah, blah, blah. And many universities have those things, and yet we don't have science studies and science critics, in the same sort of way. So I think that one of the reasons why I supervised the transformation of a program on science, technology, and society to a Department of Science and Technology Studies, but at Harvard, where I had the luxury to make my one-woman program anything by name, I chose to go backward in time and to call it the Program on Science, Technology, and Society, is that I did not want to fight that privilege battle with the scientists and engineers who will remain my natural allies if I say that what I'm trying to do, which you guys can't possibly do, is explore the contextual relationship between the science and the engineering and the surrounding society. So it's that stuff that I say is the subject matter of STS. Now, moreover, of course, I'm extremely well aware that existing disciplines tend to believe that the additive total of sociology of science, anthropology of science, psychology of science, economics of science, et cetera, make up STS to such a degree that you do not need STS. This is precisely what I'm trying to fight with my archipelago model. I think that there is possible an object-centered inquiry which actually proceeds in a more inductive fashion and produces questions and produces ways of looking at the world that are different from starting in a deductivist way with the framings of the existing disciplines. Now, this is completely apart from another major concern, which is that it's been historically shown for about 70 years now that those core major traditional disciplines will actually try to extrude their of science people when given a chance. History departments don't love historians of science, and sociology departments, God knows, don't love sociologists of science, and so on and, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, you know, this varies a little by country and culture, you know, varies from here to there, but leaving aside that practicality, I think the much more important thing for me conceptually is that if you say, you know, where is the impetus for a deep going reflexive, you know, function of modernity or postmodernity going to come from that looks at science and technology in all their ramifications, historical, contemporary, futuristic, and does it in an intellectually responsible, coherent way, that is not going to be the sum total of these other things. I think it needs a new island.
Wonderful. I think this is a great point to open. I'm coming to you. We're opening the floor now for discussion. I have Desmond on my list, but I'll let Rudolf and Jane
Okay. What? I was just
and then Desmond, you're after that, and people just raise your hands, and I'll put you on my list.
Okay, I just wanted to respond to the idea that philosophy of science only connected to itself, and history of technology and history of science only connected to itself. As you might know, there's a very famous story of four dejected researchers going down a hill after having gone to the society, the History Society, asking for a little place for their own history of science and history of technology, and being given rejected and realizing that they were going to have to form their own society. One of these was our hybrid Scandinavian Tom Hughes, who went on to form the history of technology. Anyway, so the dynamics are complicated there. It's not always a self-imposed exile, something like that. So I just wanted to say that. The other thing about Sheila's comment, the lessons from building up STS, at least in Sweden, is that you have both these volcanic islands. Then you also have, because there aren't enough islands, you have people in history departments, in sociology, in anthropology, obviously. So you have both things. You have protected spaces, and then you have people in these different places. So. Just one other.
And they're like stranded on the islands. Yeah.
Well,
I see. They're like Robinson Crusoe. No. Not really. Sorry. Desmond.
I just wanted to pick up the idea of a privileged observer, because I think, and I say, you know, privileged in relation to what audience, to what power, to what authority. And you mentioned economics, and a privileged observer of economics is certainly an economist, and not the least privileged, that's for sure. So if you take that as perhaps an extreme example, I mean, privileged.
I don't understand this in a legal sense, endowed with privileges which one can claim, but I only mean it in a descriptive, empirical sense. That observer who is most fascinating for all those who are interested in understanding the dynamics of science, and that's competition is open. That is my point, and privilege is only. The interest and fascination of readers and you get for some time and are in danger to lose at any time. I don't mean more. Privilege is not a legal claim in this understanding.
Yeah.
come on, people. It's your turn now. If you want to continue discussing the privileged position, you might do that. If you want to tell us about sort of establishing STS things in other countries, as was suggested, you might
may
do that.
At one point
and you may
to
certainly continue.
Because you are, of course, right. If you say we have an interesting way of understanding how science works and processes in the modern world, then you will have scientists, practicing scientists, who will say, we know more about it, and you do not really understand my business. That's, you're right. But in reality, they don't do it, and they can't do it. It's
who
scientists themselves. They, what they do, and that's another interesting cognitive practice which becomes ever more important in our days, what they can do and do in an instructive way is writing popular science. And that's a big world in itself, sometimes called third culture by people such as John Brockman and others. It's in itself a very interesting and very productive undertaking which produces big books, but it's not about, it doesn't generate a scientific understanding of science.
Well, you and I are completely on the same page and don't disagree at all that scientists can't do it for the same reasons that the person internalist of the culture is not going to be the critical observer. But, you know, the popularizing science thing is not so innocent. I mean, it's not simply that it is that science has spawned this. There's a concurrent reshaping of society as it looks from the scientist's point
of
view,
of course,
which is a profoundly...
That's
very, you know,
such it's very interesting.
Kind
of course.
Eric?
I wonder the dilemma with attaching the word critical to discipline. Is that possible? Or is that a contradiction in some way? At least to me, it seems like STS wants the resources of a discipline, and then they say that our discipline is going to be an anti-discipline. So, I think of two examples in Norway. I don't know them very well, but it was the formation of social psychology and social pedagogy. I don't know if they exist anymore, but they were defined in terms in to be critical, and that can function a certain period of time, and then they are absorbed. It's not possible to be a stable discipline based on the idea of being critical. So maybe STS will last a period of time, my question is, can a discipline in the long run be defined by its criticality?
Sheila, sounds like a question
for
you.
If that's a question for me, then, you know, STS is not called critical science studies. You'd be amused to hear that we once had a dinner table conversation about this. My son is a neuroscientist, my daughter's a historian, my husband's a historical linguist, and I'm an STS scholar. So we were talking about things, and I mentioned that my new friends at the law school talked about how critical legal studies had died, and my son said, well, of course, any field that has critical in front of it is doomed to die. So, you know, but it's a nominalism point. I don't think that, I mean, the word critical is subject to many different interpretations, and what my late colleague Dorothy Nelkin always used to say to the scientists was that when she said critical, she meant it in the sense of film criticism and literary criticism, where the critics are actually accepted as part of the political economy of the field, because people actually wouldn't appreciate the field so much if those critics weren't out there publicizing what's done in a friendly but nevertheless slightly orthogonal way. So you can't always explain all of this, but I don't represent STS as being a field critical of science. I explain it as a field that's interpretive and that has that kind of role in society of being the field that promotes reflection, promotes interpretation promotes an ongoing monitoring and understanding, you know, which to me are part of responsible critique, but that's not how I describe it.
Thank you. Jonathan?
I consider myself a historian of science, which is like the boring, inoffensive subaltern discipline, whereas not even clearest discipline. I work in a university, in a science university, and I mean, the way I see it is that the problem is a problem of critical mass to exist, because their departments, their physics department, chemistry department, biology department, all the individual biologists, chemists, physicists, they love us because they haven't got time to do it themselves, but they love the idea of the history of physics, the history of biology, the history of chemistry. But as soon as there's a possibility of a job that comes up, they're going to give it to a biologist or a chemist or a physicist because they have disciplinary interests. Not even because they need necessarily a biologist or a chemist or a physicist, but if they give it to someone else, they lose a job, and that's that in the power politics of university, that doesn't work. So I mentioned before that I'm opposed to disciplines is basically on for this kind of reason that. You know, there can be a consensual opinion that we need this, we want this, but there's a logic, a disciplinary logic, which makes decisions which are against what everyone agrees they want. But then when Sheila Jasanov talked about, you know, anti-disciplines, it seems that the anti-discipline movement is worse than, you know, maybe it's better like that than having university administrators flatten disciplines. This Michael Crowe guy sounds terrible. I mean, it sounds like he's getting rid of disciplines just so he can manipulate faculty exactly how he wants. But in fact, disciplines provide protections to the biologists, chemists and physicists, and maybe I should just give up on history of science because in the greater good, it's better to have a bit of defence around physicists, biologists and chemists than have an open playing field in which university presidents hire and fire people as they see fit, because, I mean, you know, the reason, or maybe one of the reasons for the existence of disciplines like the existence of nations is that, you know, it does serve a purpose, that, you know, if you dissolve a nation, that does, you know, leave the population open or exposed in certain ways that nations do. You know, nations have armies and police forces and they do protect, and disciplines function in a similar protective way. So, you know, I feel I'm like inoffensive, but I kind of, you know, the long term, I don't see how to go forward. And I imagine people in STS are in a similar situation. I mean, you know, maybe American universities are a bit more open, but when push comes to shove, there's a disciplinary reflex, and when there's like a job to give, it's people with the most clout to, or like groups with the most clout to, who get the job or get the funding or get the new building.
Jane.
I'd just like to say, there's a comment here, and I hope Sheila would agree with me, is that STS was neither born in, nor espouses, nor practice anti-disciplinarity. We are constantly in dialogue with various disciplines all the time. And I think that was part of what you were talking about here. It's really a clear point for us. And I just wanted, I might as well do a little advertising here for the latest issue of Science, Technology and Human Values by some well-known Norwegian scholars, including Kristin Astal here, which is a dialogue between STS and history and looking at specific issues. And it's taking up various aspects of that meeting point from a certain perspective known as context. And it's just an example of the many, many meetings we have, dialogues we are dependent upon, dialogues on, we are rooted in disciplines.
Thank you. Ruff, you want to address that?
Yeah, please. Just a small comment to what you said before. If you, well, in a way, the idea of the notion of a discipline protects, I agree. And you can also link that, I think, with the notion of Andrew Abbott of fractals. If you look at the way that for sociology would be a good candidate to have kind of sociology of science, if you look at the way that it is divided, you have, let's say, around the middle of the 20th century sociology of knowledge, which emerged. You can think of Karl Mannheim, Max Scheler, and some others. And then you have, in a way, another division, in the sense of a sociology of scientific knowledge that one stresses as SSK. And this is, I think, the more common way in which one can find support within the university for a particular kind of specialization, for a particular kind of subdisciplinary division. If you do it like STS, it's more like it's something else, which is not neatly, which cannot neatly be situated within a kind of division. If you have a kind of, let's say, psychology of science, if you have economics of science, well, it's rather easy, and you can rely on the protection of the discipline, and one can have good arguments to say that one needs an extra position which takes care of this. But when you try to combine a number of things, for example, science and technology, it makes you more vulnerable to claims from others who can rely on a certain kind of tradition, on a certain kind of background, to say that they have privileged rights.
Mila?
Yeah, I actually had the same question as Henrik, but let me try and specify it a little bit and address it maybe to Jane. As an outside observer of STS, I'm wondering sometimes if there is a split within STS also as to what strategy to adopt. I think there's a paper by Steve Wolver who is afraid that STS should become complacent in middle age and move out and live in the suburbs, I think he says some ways.
Which he himself does quite successfully.
I guess you know more about this than I do. But viewed from the outside, that's one, you know, there's a certain, this excitement, this danger, there's this position of the outsider, the subversive position that might be attracted to some people within the SDS community. And whereas others would prefer not to live in the suburbs, but would prefer spaces for conversation that are materially secure, in a sense, and to provide professional opportunities for students, for instance. That's a major issue, I understand. Is there such a split within STS as to which direction to move, or is the view that you voiced today, Sheila, consensual?
Jane?
Heterogeneity is one of our guidelines. There's just so many different perspectives on this, and the idea you address a couple of different issues. You talk about the renewal, and if we're still, the exciting new kids on the block. If you figure that the first science studies unit was established in Edinburgh in 1959, Cornell in 1969, you have people who've been around a long time. They've maybe moved out to the suburbs. But you also have a lot of new people coming in the whole time. I mean, all of our doctoral students keep us on our feet. But this issue is always being discussed. How are we? And every time you go to the 4S meetings, which is our annual meetings, and you see more people in ties, people get a little worried, right, because we're no longer that. But, I mean, that's a really symbolization because there's so much going on. And I'm continually amazed by the vibrancy when I go to workshops and meetings, because I think... I wouldn't universalize saying I know of these and these and these strategies. I think it's very local and very situated.
If I could, yeah. Can I just say something about this? This was the capture argument that I mentioned in one of my slides was precisely about this bourgeoisification of the field. But it's ridiculous. I mean, history doesn't think that all historians have been eliminated to the suburbs. I mean, if it's a disciplined way of thought, it has modes of self-regeneration within it. I mean, it's just incredibly difficult to persuade people that a new emergence is needed because they're kind of stuck in their rutted ways of thought. They have, in that sense, the disciplines become, to some degree, bourgeoisified. And, I think you use disciplines in two different ways in the little thing that you said before. On the one hand, you think Michael Crowe is a menace because he's dissolving disciplines. On the other hand, you're bemoaning disciplines because they're rooting out historians of science because they prefer biologists. Well, I mean, I presented Michael Crowe not because I'm saying everybody should be like him, but because I'm saying that the disciplinarity, interdisciplinarity dyad actually doesn't get us to where we want to be, which is to think whether we need a sort of sustained, mature, reflective capability on being scientific and technological civilizations. I think we do.
Neil.
Thank you for this discussion. I was a bit within STS for a couple of years, but mainly I'm a lawyer, but also working in a very cross-disciplinary way at the law school. And so this is very similar to the discussions you have also at school like that, where you have the legal dogmatics field, which are, of course, the dominant in numbers by both students and teachers. And then you have legal sociology, legal history, legal philosophy, legal economics. And there's always this discussion of who, exactly as you're saying, who is the primary observer here. And, of course, the legal dogmatics are very threatened by people from some of the law and disciplines when they come and say, this is how this question has to be understood. Lawyers don't get this, or this is how law should be understood. Yeah. If you say that from a legal historian or legal sociologist or legal economics point of view, many of the more classical lawyers will just shake their head and say no. So I just think that maybe it's totally unavoidable, inevitable to have these discussions and controversies. There is a controversy of what is the prioritized observation on any kind of discipline or field or social field. So STS would be the same thing to many of the more natural sciences or other types of sciences. And so I think our job is to insist on a sort of meta-thinking where all these approaches to science are accepted and that the controversies are accepted. So, I mean, you have to fight and befriend at the same time in a way. But of course, sometimes it comes down to, you know, who gets the next position which is available, and that is, you know, that's always unavoidable. But I think if there is an acceptance, and to some extent we have that, at the law school in Oslo now, some kind of acceptance that because that has been a strength over some years, that you have the legal sociology department, you have a legal history group, you have a legal economics group, and you have some legal philosophers and theorists, and that is a strength. But of course it's always a struggle to within the legal department to among the different lawyers on, you know, is it sufficiently fruitful to have these other areas. So I just think it's a controversy. We have to take it upon ourselves to continue to fight. But my experience from that is that, you know, it may be okay to be within a larger school, but to be accepted as an equal type of sub-discipline as tort law, criminal law, etc.
Ruth, do you want to... That was sort of support for your idea that there always has to be a privileged position. You want to... say something?
I don't mean it in a normative sense, but I think at the end there will arise a discipline which is the most influential cognitive approach to observe scientific knowledge processes in a scientific way. And I think it's a historical question, and I want to stress one further point which several times arose today, for example, in the morning in the talk of Lars Kvertrup. I think one argument which is important is that nobody in the world can abolish or forbid or discontinue a scientific discipline. Not even an influential university president can do this. I mentioned this yesterday. Harvard abolished geography in 1948. Of course, it's an important event if such a famous university abolishes geography, but as we all know, didn't end the history of geography as a scientific discipline, because a discipline is something which I would say it's a self-organizing knowledge system which depends on knowledge processes and communication processes incessantly going on. And as long as this is the case, you will have this discipline. And for this, it needs problems, concepts, theories, paradigms, however you want to call these elementary constituents. But organizations, for example, universities, are only environments of these knowledge and communication processes. And of course they can decide, but these decisions are only relevant for themselves, for the universities which decide. And disciplines are much bigger entities, much more extensive social systems, which today, without exceptions, are global knowledge systems, and they do not depend on individual decisions, and they do not depend on decisions at all. They depend on ongoing communication and knowledge processes.
Last question or comment from Anne Rabbit?
I wanted to basically pile on to the last commenter. In a certain sense, it's always about the next job. We all, for the most part, are talking about employment in academia. And one of the things that I had never thought before about STS is that it would be interesting to think how the meeting of society would be transformed if STS were a discipline and the meeting became, like all the disciplinary meetings, a meat market. One of the reasons that none of us in sociology finds the American Sociological Association meeting very interesting intellectually is that the main thing that's done at the meeting is the exchange of candidates and possibilities for positions. It's basically a very horse trading here. And when I think about the Social Science History Association meeting that I go to every year, which is exactly like the STS meeting, throws together a bunch of different fields, one of the reasons we all love it is that, in fact, there are no jobs. We actually go to the sessions instead of sitting around in the corners. And it's interesting to think of what would be the price of success to making a discipline. So that's one point. Yeah. The second point is that it's important to realize there are lots of other things that are trying to become disciplines, and it would be useful to sort of broaden the discussion. So thinking about what is done about, for example, race and gender in American universities, they typically don't become disciplines, although in some places they have, but often they lead to centers which have half lines, which are then located partly in a department, and they also have a center line. So just so people are aware that that's a common solution for this problem in the U.S. It's also true that in a way, more successful than SDS, race, and gender would be the sort of some of the hyphenated American type things. So there are a fair number of African American studies departments in American universities. That is something that has spread, and it has a discipline that has a meeting that exchanges jobs and so on. So it is possible for this move to be made, although if you think, how does African American studies really come into existence as a discipline, it's driven overwhelmingly by undergraduate student demand. So that, it comes back to the issue that in America often it's the case that the disciplines are hostage in some sense to undergraduate student enrollment. That's one of the things that really drives. So I just want to make the point that there are lots of other kinds of disciplines to think about, and there are other forms of institutional arrangements besides creating a separate whole discipline.
Thank you. A last short comment?
Just a couple of short comments back to you, Andrew. I think of myself as a startup rather than a scale-up person, and the Science and Democracy Network thing that I mentioned is a combination of your jobs-creating enterprise and a meeting that people like to go to. It obeys the rule of the Dunbar number, apparently, because it's approximately 150 people, of whom about a third show up to each meeting. So it's all plenary, it's all intellectually interesting, but it has actually produced the kinds of networking that lead to jobs in an as yet not disciplined field. The other thing is that I'm, of course, having been in this, you know, institution-making mode for a very long time, totally familiar with the kinds of things you mention and the kinds of things that Rudolf mentions as well. And I didn't come to the idea that STS ought to be a field of its own without an enormous amount of, you know, sort of reflection and observation along the way. I'm not wedded to the view that it can't be like the gender studies things where it would have a half position and be able to negotiate with others and so on. What I am kind of deeply committed to by now is that you actually need people sitting side by side thinking about similar sorts of things, and you need them across the things that are currently divided up as history and anthropology and so on and so forth. And there has been, in my experience, a kind of richness that comes about from looking at science and technology in their wholeness, that is, as social enterprises embedded in society. And that, you know, I think that more stuff has come out of that, of an interesting and illuminating nature from, you know, from my position intellectually. That's why I'm committed to this idea of field making in STS, and not because of a sheer love of space or a sheer love of meat markets, which I don't like any more than you do.
Jen?
Yeah, just coming into that, coming from a center for STS and innovation studies rather than a department. The whole idea of the field making, one of the functions of the meetings, and it is, you know, positioning and jobs, it's also showing individual researchers who might be the only person in STS at a small department in rural whatever, that there are other people you can talk with about these type of issues. And it's creating kind of an intellectual home. And I would like to think that we have the vibrancy despite all the job positioning and things. And I think that's a really important function of these meetings.
Yeah.
It creates a space. To get back to the first comment.
Rudolf, last final words?
Only a small story. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz made his whole life plans for new scientific institutions to be established in due time. And in 1680, when he wrote one plan for an academy to be established, he finished this plan, and then he wrote a dedication on the top of this plan. And the dedication was "Ad monarchiam qui volet," to the monarch who wants it. And I find that remarkable. That's the kind of opportunism you need in science. There have to be enough monarchs in the world, therefore more states are better than a small number of states, and if there are enough monarchs, you will find someone for the plans, but you won't change your plans for a specific monarch. That's some...
Well, as a German scholar, I think it's a wonderful to end this conference with Leibniz. That makes me cry almost. So we're rounding off. Some thank yous are in order. But before, I want to say that those of you who go on the excursion tomorrow, we have an excursion. I might call it field work if you want. You meet up at 1:30 at the National Theater. Okay? 1:30 National Theater. Information is also on our website. So, I'd like to thank everyone for coming from, traveling a long way, like from Bangladesh, for instance, and I mean from the States, and giving us such a wonderful meeting with very interesting keynotes, very interesting papers, good discussions, and a lot of stamina. I mean, it's Friday, it's almost 5:30, and you're still here, so I think it's great to have had you all here. There's some special thank yous in order. So, Vila, if you can just come up here. And Beata.
Yeah.
So, we never explain this, really. I know, you know, you can see that there's a ceiling inside. But it's not any ceiling. It's a ceiling of the oldest building of the university also. The old, the government fest itself. So, I'll just do that. You've done all the planning. Very great planning, I mean thorough, and found the right people. I mean, it was quite obvious that when they came that they were the right people. It's been very elegantly done, everything. And I mean, it's your brainchild also, so I mean, the thinking behind this has also turned out to be the right way to think. So thank you on behalf of Kultrans and University of Oslo, and I mean, we ended with Leibniz, and we're talking disciplines, and we're talking sort of the heritage from the Enlightenment, in a sense. So the book I'm giving you is about the heritage from the Enlightenment, and it's called Man, just to make him forget that it's not all knowledge systems. So there you go. Thank you. Congratulations on the wonderful conference. And, thank you.